From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Albert Brooks about his new satirical film, Looking for Comedy in the Muslim World. Brooks plays a comic and actor named Albert Brooks, who's asked by the State Department to go to India and Pakistan to learn what makes Muslims laugh so that the U.S. can better understand the Muslim people of the world. Then we'll talk with the creator of the Book of Daniel, the controversial TV series about an Episcopal priest who talks to Jesus about his family problems, church politics, and his reliance on Vicodin. Conservative and Christian groups have protested the show. 9 NBC affiliates have dropped the series. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Our critic at large, John Powers, once described Albert Brooks as the funniest man in America. Now Brooks has a new movie that he wrote, directed, and stars in that's all about what makes people laugh. It's called Looking for Comedy in the Muslim World. Albert Brooks plays a comic and actor named Albert Brooks who's having trouble finding a film role. Then he gets a surprising offer from a new government commission that's been created to better understand the Muslim people of the world. The commissioner, Fred Thompson, is played by the former Senator Fred Thompson, who is now a regular on Law and Order. Here's Commissioner Thompson explaining his offer to Albert Brooks.
The president, as you know, has a pretty darn good sense of humor. And he felt that maybe the only way to really understand somebody was to see what makes them laugh. So, we'd like for you to head up a project. Take a month, go to India and Pakistan, write a 500-page report, and tell us what makes the Muslims laugh. You'd be doing a hell of a service for your country.
Brooks accepts the offer. The first thing he does in India is hold job interviews to find himself an assistant.
Do you type?
No, I do not type.
You don't type at all?
No, they didn't say anything about typing.
I'm wondering if they even gave you the job description correctly. Do you know why you're here?
Yes, I was told I'll be an assistant to a big American star.
Well, that part is true.
Who is it?
It's Mel Gibson.
Oh, my goodness. Could I just lie a little bit and say I type? I would love to work with Mel Gibson, please.
Normally, I could say you could tell a little lie, but you don't want to lie to Mel. Did you see The Passion of the Christ?
Yes, I did.
You don't want that to happen to you.
No.
She's hardly the only person in this movie who doesn't get Brooks's jokes, but usually the joke ends up on him. Albert Brooks, welcome back to Fresh Air. How did you first come up with the idea for Looking for Comedy in the Muslim World? Like, what was the very beginning of the idea?
Well, the beginning of the idea was about, I would say, a year and a half after 9/11, sitting home, being scared all the time, watching the terror warnings and being told that we're living in a new world. I began to think, well, you know, how do I function in this new world? What do I do? And I wasn't seeing any motion pictures. And nothing was addressing this post-9/11 a life that we're all leading. It's interesting, if you look at the films that have risen to the top of 2005, they're virtually all set in the past. Brokeback Mountain, Munich, Good Night and Good Luck.
Capote,
every one of them. And I don't know if this is conscious or an accidental, if it's a coincidence, but it seems like people just were not dealing with the world we're living in. And especially there's, you know, no motion picture comedies that even want to talk about this subject. If a comedy is set in the present, it's mostly a teenage sex comedy and it deals with, getting laid. Right. So it just got to me after a while. And I thought, how do I even get into this door? The other thing that was, and still is, when I started writing this and even filming it, Karen Hughes had not been brought back to Washington. I think her job is now called head of PR to the Muslim world. There was nobody doing anything. So part of the premise, of course, is that, you know, the government decides to do something other than, like Fred Thompson says, all the normal things, spying and fighting. And it was the combination of those two things, just acknowledging that we're now living in a world that is different and the government tells us it's going to be like this forever, and the idea that we're not doing anything to reach people on a human-to-human level. Even if this idea is too absurd, there are ideas that could be tried.
So you go to India and try interviewing people about what makes them laugh. Is that an answerable question? Could you answer it?
Well, you know, I don't know that it's an answerable question. You know, one of the things that I did a long time ago in my career was I started the Albert Brooks Famous School for Comedians to teach people to be funny. And
right.
I had a test in Esquire magazine that you could fill out to see if you were funny. And, of course, it was done as a satire, but I think Esquire got like 300-400 serious replies. And the whole point of that is I never believe and still don't that you could teach anyone to be funny, nor do I really believe... You know, listen, you can find out a joke that makes people laugh, but sense of humor is... I've been trying to make Americans laugh my whole life. I still can't tell you what they really laugh at. You know, I can use my own movies and see 200 people falling on the floor and 30 people looking at them. So I don't know. It's not like tragedy. Tragedy is... Everywhere, it's the same. You lose a child, you lose a parent. Every human on the planet's going to have the same emotion. Well, maybe not the Menendez brothers, but, you know, most all of us. But sense of humor, not only is it hard to peg, it changes. You know, what people find funny in 2005, they may not find funny in 2006. And that's another thing about humor. It fluctuates. So it's interesting. In India and Pakistan, well, especially India, India is, the majority is population is Hindu, and there are, well, the minority Muslim population is 150 million, which makes it the second largest Muslim country in the world. And then there's a tremendous Sikh population. So our crew was made up of those three sects of people. And, you know, as they got to know me, the Hindus would tell me Sikh jokes, and, you know, the Sikhs would tell me Muslim jokes. So my answer began, somebody said, what makes people laugh? And my answer was the other guy. You know, that's seemingly what people laugh at, the guy over there.
In the movie, in your attempt to find out what makes people laugh, you give a stand-up performance. And part of the act that you do, which I think is incredibly funny, is you play like the most ridiculous ventriloquist in the world. And so you're like, your lips are really moving as you're doing the ventriloquism.
Right.
And you know, there's a standard ventriloquist shtick where the ventriloquist drinks water while the dummy's singing so the ventriloquist could show how good he is at ventriloquism. You do this, except you force the dummy to drink the water.
So that's right.
It's just absurd. But what I love about this is that you actually did this act in your early comedy career.
It was the very first piece of material I ever did was the world's worst ventriloquist, Danny and Dave. And, you know, I wanted to revive it. Of course, you revive it. You know, there's a funny scene later in the movie where John Carroll Lynch, playing one of the government guys who's like a frustrated comedian, says, you know, why would you choose to do a satire or a ventriloquism when you don't even know if they know what a ventriloquist is? And, you know, I say to him, well, how do I know that they don't know? He says, there's no ventriloquism in India. Just it always makes me laugh. But Danny and Dave was the first bit that I ever did, and I wanted to bring back Danny to try it out in front of this audience overseas. And, of course, it didn't go over as well as it used to on Ed Sullivan. And then I do other various things. It's my attempt, as I come up with the idea in the movie, to try as varied a bunch of material that I can come up with so I'll understand what their sense of humor is by what they laugh at. Unfortunately, that premise needs someone to laugh at something, and I have my troubles with that audience.
Now, this Danny and Dave ventriloquism thing that you do, the bit that you do in India in the movie to see if it makes people laugh, I'll bet when you did it on TV in your early career that a lot of people didn't laugh at it because it's a joke about... It's not a ventriloquism act. It's a joke about ventriloquism. And I bet a lot of people didn't get it then and that you might have even bombed when you were doing it in your real act.
Terry, I have so many pieces of material that people didn't laugh at in the beginning of my career. And if, you know, it's going to sound funny to say, but if I used laughter as a judge, I never would have stayed in the comedy field. I just did these things and audiences had no idea who I was. I mean, the first time I ever did Danny and Dave on Steve Allen on the old Westinghouse show, and he introduced me as Danny and Dave, and everyone in that audience thought I was Danny and Dave. But, you know, I used to do a mime that came out and never shut up. All he did was talk. People weren't sure of that. This was sort of my early career, and it was interesting because when I finally got to The Tonight Show, I'd already done years of the big shows like Ed Sullivan, but when you finally get to The Tonight Show, then the only person everybody watches is Johnny, because I used to do bits on The Tonight Show and the audience wasn't sure, but Johnny was laughing, and in essence, Johnny was the audience. If the audience was roaring at you on The Tonight Show and Johnny didn't like you, you'd never be back.
What made you think about taking real bits that you did in your stand-up act early in your comedy career and giving them to the character that you play in Looking for Comedy in the Muslim World?
Well, since the character I play is Albert Brooks, and, you know, Albert hasn't been on a stage for years and years and years, well, I mean, you know, we sort of dress up Danny to make him look more like he, you know, looks like the character I'm playing in the movie. And it was, you know, this sort of attempt to reach into my old stand-up bag and pull out what I can. Although the bit that I do at the end of the of that show, that improvisation bit, mm-hmm. is a new piece of material. I'm very fond of that. I tried that out once on a Saturday night about 9 years ago when I just wandered in. I went into the improv one night in Los Angeles and got up on stage just because I don't know, I've always had something bothers me about this whole improv idea of comedy. I don't know why, it just bothers me. So I always liked the potential idea of a comedian taking suggestions and ignoring them completely. So that was really, but I never really fleshed it out. The movie is the first fleshed out version of that routine, which if I were performing live today, I'd do every night. It makes me laugh.
My guest is Albert Brooks. His new movie is called Looking for Comedy in the Muslim World. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Albert Brooks. He wrote, directed, and stars in the new satirical film Looking for Comedy in the Muslim World. He plays a comic named Albert Brooks, who's sent by the State Department to India and Pakistan to learn what makes Muslims laugh. When we left off, we were talking about a scene in which he does a stand-up act for an audience in India that doesn't get any of his jokes. How did you train the audience in the theater in India not to laugh at your jokes even if they thought they were funny? For the movie, they have to be totally not moved by by your comedy.
We train them with peanuts and a large whip. No. Look, that audience had to be brought in. So that, what looks like it takes place in real time, you know, is shot over 4 days. The audience was there for 2.5 days because you're getting 70 angles of that scene. So you start out and you talk to the audience and, you know, they want to laugh. And they did laugh at Danny a little. And then you tell them, okay, now don't laugh because it's part of the movie. Then when you tell an audience not to laugh, two people laugh, then everyone laughs at them. So you just sort of have to wear them down. The lucky thing is it was about 111 in there. And by noon, the first day, I didn't have a problem. Nobody was laughing. It even got to the other side where, you know, when do we eat? What time is lunch? Okay, quiet. Don't yell. You can't do that either. So the audience, you know, in the first 2-3 hours was there to have fun, even though in my mind they were there to work in my movie. And we just, you know, wore them down.
One of the things you're up against in the movie when you're performing is that this auditorium you've been placed in has no bathroom, there's no dressing room, the stage lights don't work. And as I watched this, I was thinking, I bet that happened to you all the time at the start of your career.
Well, one of the things that really did happen to me that's in the movie was nobody, when I used to like open for Neil Diamond, which I did for a number of years, there was nobody to introduce me. You know, I could introduce Neil, but nobody could introduce me. So I used to put on this phony voice, "Good evening, ladies and gentlemen," and, you know, and then try to, you know, give myself a host of credits and try to impress them. You've seen this. I always like when they tell an audience, "You've seen." I don't know. What do you mean I've seen? I don't even know who it is. "You've seen them. You've liked them. You've clapped before." You know, you try to do that. So, you know, this is in this situation, the Sikh gentleman, he's, you know, "Can you introduce me?" "I'm not qualified to do that. I don't like to talk in front of people." So I'm sort of, you know, forced to build myself up with my own voice, which really did happen.
Now, there's a character who you're interviewing for a job in the movie to be your assistant, and she asks you a question, "Are you Jewish?"
And if, yeah, she says, "You're not a Jew, are you?"
Yeah. So is that a fact that you were anxious to let slip or preferred not to let slip while you were doing the movie? Did people know you were Jewish, and did that make a difference to anyone?
Well, you know, I have my "I'm Jewish" fluorescent hat, but I left that in Los Angeles. No, you know, listen, you're making a movie called Looking for Comedy in the Muslim World. I am a Jewish filmmaker. I think this is the movie to acknowledge it here and there. It only seems appropriate. It would be like a subject that, you know, if I didn't do it, it would be like a cheat. So, you know, that woman says, "You're not a Jew, are you?" And I think my answer is not at this moment. So one of the things, Terry, that I felt I needed to do more than maybe my other movies was make as much, you know, not hide anything and make fun of myself. And then I thought I'd be okay. If I put myself holier than thou in a movie like this, then, you know, it would be trouble. Then it might actually look like I'm, you know, poking fun at something. But if the central character and is me and I'm the buffoon and I'm willing to make myself the buffoon, then, you know, other people sort of will get into that spirit.
What was it like to actually get permission to film where you ended up filming in India? Who did you have to go through?
Well, it's a very complicated process. First, what I had to do was go to India initially for like 2.5 weeks to understand it, to meet with the one of the ministers. You know, I was taken there by people who have, you know, great knowledge of filming there. And I started to write this script without going to India, and I just wasn't describing it correctly. It was like, you know, the character Albert walks out of his hotel and sees bright lights like Las Vegas, and, you know, it was just not India. So I knew I had to go in order to write it correctly, and I had to go through the entire movie with these two gentlemen, and they had to say, okay. Now, once they say okay, all that means is you can come in our country. It's not like Los Angeles or any other American city that has a film commission where one okay can also give you rights to, you know, shoot at the dock or the Empire State Building. It's nothing like that. You get a central okay just to come there, just to get visas to the country. You then have to get okays from the various cities and states and buildings and monuments, and, you know, shooting at the Taj Mahal was like a nightmare of paperwork. But, you know, we got it.
What was it like to film at the Taj Mahal?
Well, the Taj Mahal was really unusual because, first of all, to get permission was, as I said, just I didn't know if it was ever going to happen. For example, they wouldn't allow I mean, in the movie, you know, I mean, the point of the Taj Mahal is, you know, I go there and never see it. And so the view that where I walk by it, that suited me well for my script. That was as close as you would ever get anyway. They don't let you closer, even with, if you went there as a tourist, they won't let you near the Taj Mahal with a little flash camera and or any camera. But for some weird reason, you know, they gave us permission. And the other thing is, there's no crowd control. The Taj Mahal's not going to keep people from coming there just because you're shooting there. So take after take after take after take, and I mean 2 days of this, were just ruined by 70 people looking in the lens. You know, the movie can handle a few people looking at me because I'm an American and I thought it was okay. That I can accept. You can actually look at a tourist that you might not normally see at the Taj, and that's okay. But you can't have dozens of people look in the lens. So we were lucky. The second day we were there, there was a huge group of Indian Army reservists visiting. And they, I think we paid them, I don't know, some agreement was reached. And they formed this daisy chain, this large group of men that ran ahead of the camera and just mowed people down. You know, I'm laughing, but I mean, you know, people were falling into the grass. And of course, I'm so, you know, the selfish director. Good. Did anyone look at the lens? No, but sir, a man has a concussion. But did he look at the lens? You know, it was like the only thing I was asking.
Albert Brooks wrote, directed, and stars in the new film Looking for Comedy in the Muslim World. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Wellington Management, providing investment management for clients worldwide. From Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Lighting Up, How I Stopped Smoking, Drinking, and Everything Else I Loved in Life Except Sex, by journalist Susan Shapiro. And from the Pew Charitable Trusts, serving the public interest through information, policy solutions, and support for civic life. Online at pewtrusts.org. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
Coming up, drugs, sex, scandal, and a beleaguered Episcopal priest doing the best he can and talking over his problems with Jesus. We talk with Jack Kenny, the creator and executive producer of the controversial new NBC series, The Book of Daniel. 9 NBC affiliates have dropped it. And we continue our interview with Albert Brooks. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Albert Brooks. He wrote, directed, and stars in the new satirical film Looking for Comedy in the Muslim World. He plays a comic named Albert Brooks, who's sent by the State Department to India and Pakistan to learn what makes Muslims laugh so that the U.S. government can better understand the Muslim people of the world. Most of the film was shot on location in India. Was anybody in India suspicious of you? Did anyone think you were really like a CIA agent or that you
Well,
had...
you mean like the mix-up in the story?
Yeah, like
I don't
the mix-up
know.
In the story.
You know, people, I don't know what they thought. You know, listen, the thing about India is it's probably the last, you know, if there was a Parker Brothers game of countries that still like us, I think India would be the only square left. They like us. And the only answer I can come up with is that the British have been such a issue with them, and, you know, we're not, so the British take the heat. That's where all when they think they have problems, they blame the British. And, you know, you're not afraid to say, I'm from America. A lot of the crew went over there with these shirts that say, I'm Canadian. You know, they didn't know what to expect.
So Sony Pictures, which initially was going to distribute Looking for Comedy in the Muslim World, didn't like your title. You ended up moving to another company. What's the story behind them wanting the change?
I think they wanted to shorten it to a Looking for Comedy.
And get out the words in the Muslim world.
That's it. Get out the words. I'm sure they would have kept Looking for Comedy in the World. I think it was the actual word Muslim. And, you know...
Because they were afraid it might be interpreted as offensive to Muslims.
Yes. Here's what they blamed it on. This came about a week and a half after that Newsweek story where there was Quran abuse in Cuba. And I think Newsweek had retracted that story. But that's what they blamed it on. I actually had a conversation with the head of the studio who said to me, look, you know, times have changed and it warrants a title change. And I said, well, you know, what time? Times have changed after 9/11. It's why I made the movie. I said, you know, Abu Ghraib was worse than this Newsweek story. Times are changing every day. It's okay to put comedy and Muslim together. I'm telling you, it's okay. And he actually said to me, he said, look, it's probably okay, but if one mullah in Iran saw the poster and reacted badly, you never know what could happen. Now, my reaction was, wait a minute. I said, I've had trouble getting posters put up in Sherman Oaks. You're telling me you're going to put them up in Iran? I said, this is good news. I said, how are they going to see it? And by the way, when I finally saw the trailers that Sony Pictures made, they had taken out the whole subject anyway. It was like Bill and Ted go to India. I mean, I was, you know, it was like a comedian decides to put on a show in another country. I said, wait a minute, where's my premise? So I think this whole idea of having Muslim in the title and anything to do with Muslim for a company the size of Sony that makes televisions and all the things they do simply just didn't fly. Why do we need that? You know, I really believe that some very high up executive said, one day, who's probably not involved in day-to-day movie business, saw this on a computer printout and said, we're not going to do this. Why do we need this? So they just were worried. And I told them the whole reason to make the movie is that I said, you need to make this movie because you need to put comedy and Muslim in the same sentence and you'll see that it's a good thing. It's not a bad thing. Comedy is a friendly word. I said, if the title was Looking for Religion or Looking for Sex, I could have an argument with you. But where is comedy a bad word in any language?
Your film premiered in Dubai at a film festival there. Why did you want that to be the premiere, and what was the reaction like?
I just will simply say it was one of the greatest nights of my life. The reason this happened was initially the film, which was financed by Steve Bing. Steve Bing has a company, Shangri-La. In his gut, he said, he just was looking for something because, you know, we found another distributor immediately. But, you know, he thought Dubai would be a place to look. Let's prove to them that there's nothing to be afraid of. And I said, well, I never said I wasn't afraid. You know, you prove it, you go, write me. But he sort of decided that he wanted this to happen. So we showed the movie to the people who run the festival, and they thought there was nothing that would cause a problem. They showed it to an Egyptian critic, and the critic seemed to just laugh, and I was still very scared to go there, only because, you know, what do I know? My friends say to me, what are you, crazy? You're going to bring the movie there? And it just turned out to be one of the great nights of my life. I'm telling you, in terms of audiences, it was like the Cinema One in New York. They not only laughed at everything, they seemed overly appreciative of the fact that there's even a comedy out now, especially from America, where the Muslims are not the bad guys. They're so sick and tired of any character that's called a Muslim being a villain. And the other thing, and, you know, I sort of learned this by going there, the tension, the post 9/11 tension is everywhere. It has nothing to do with us. You know, our buildings came down, but there's been 700 explosions since then, and mostly they've been, you know, they've been everywhere else in the world. And 99.8% of this planet doesn't want trouble. But one other thing, they also laughed at the languages without even the translations coming up. So, you know, I was getting laughs like before the American audiences have to read. There were enough people who spoke, of course, everybody speaks Arabic, but there were people who spoke Urdu, and there were people in the audience who spoke Hindu, and it was just Hindi, and it was just interesting, just wild. It was a great night.
So, you know, you said that you were actually, like, scared at some point. I don't know how scared you really were, but you know, doing something like this movie has different risks than just flop sweat, you know? Yeah. You're like, you're going to countries you've never been in before, that you don't speak the language. You're going to countries during an era of terrorism. You're doing something that you certainly don't mean to be offensive at all, but it's possible somebody would interpret it the wrong way and find offense. And you're a Jew making a movie about trying to make Muslims laugh, and that might be a kind of sensitive thing, too. So this is like a new world you're entering in terms of a performer.
By the way, I'm making a list as you're reeling them off.
Are you getting worried?
I'm scared reading the list.
Yeah.
No, but that is the answer. All of those reasons. You know, there's no roadmap. Nobody can tell me, well, last year the festival showed Jack Smith goes to the Muslim world and it went fine. They actually told me that in the first year of the festival, they showed a Control Room, the Al Jazeera documentary, and that a sizable amount of people booed and walked out.
Oh, why?
Oh, I don't know, but they just were. That was that audience.
There's a running gag, you know. You're trying to, like, win people over so they'll answer your questions about what makes them laugh when you first get to India, and you're trying to do interviews to find this out. And people don't know who the heck you are. And the only glimmer of recognition you get is when you explain that you were in Finding Nemo and that you were the voice of a fish. So was that what reality was like for you, too, that was the only point of connection? And was that, in fact, like, did a lot of people in India see Finding Nemo?
No, because mostly it would be dubbed anyway.
Oh, of course. Oh, yeah, my God. I didn't even get that one. You
that's
see?
Why, yeah. This is... that's why it was. There's the
oh,
joke.
Oh, that's so great. No.
See, now, by the way,
here's like an English speaking American who loves your humor, and it went right past me.
Let me turn to the judge. Your Honor, I rest my case. It's impossible. That's funny.
Oh, that's so great. And I might say I was even priding myself on getting a lot of the in-jokes because I know some of your early work.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. Well, you know, but in America, young children weren't watching Modern Romance. So, you know, I have been stopped more than I think is pleasant in markets and have cell phones shoved in my face. And please say something. Please say just anything like Marlon to my son. Where's your son? He's on the phone. You know, so that's sort of weird.
Is there a part of you, just even a small part of you, that hopes that your movie, Looking for Comedy in the Muslim World, is going to help promote world peace?
Well, you know, your laughter says it all.
Right.
Listen, I don't believe I wish I did. I don't believe movies can change the world to that degree. I can't imagine the movie that would bring the Israelis and the Palestinians to the peace table. But, you know, the old Jewish joke, it couldn't hurt.
No, but some people think it could hurt. That's just the thing.
Yeah, but let me tell you something. You know, even it is really important to finally elevate these scary subjects to a point where you can make comedies about them. So this is the first one. There should be 100. Because if nothing else, it takes this fear. You know, I have young children. I don't want them. If something bad's going to happen to us, it's going to happen anyway. I don't want to see myself and my family hover in a corner waiting for that day. I'd rather get some laughs waiting. And you know, I just think it's necessary.
Well, Albert Brooks, thank you so much for talking with us.
Terry, it's always a pleasure.
Albert Brooks wrote, directed, and stars in the new film Looking for Comedy in the Muslim World. Coming up, the creator of the controversial new TV series, The Book of Daniel. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Jack Kenny, is the creator and executive producer of the new NBC series, The Book of Daniel. Part drama, part comedy, the series is about an Episcopal priest named Daniel Webster, who's married and has 3 children. His oldest son is gay. The priest has no problem with that, but he is concerned about his adopted teenage son, who's sleeping with his girlfriend, and he's very worried about his teenage daughter, who was busted selling marijuana. Church politics are getting to him, too. He's become reliant on Vicodin, which eases his back pain and helps with the stress. And we see him talking over his problems with Jesus. Several conservative and Christian groups have campaigned against the show and urged people to write to NBC and the show's sponsors. 9 NBC affiliates have dropped it. It's been difficult for the network to find sponsors. Here's a scene from the pilot in which Daniel and his family are at the dining room table the day after the daughter's arrest. Daniel is played by Aidan Quinn.
Praise him above, ye heavenly hosts. Praise Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. Amen.
Grace, don't you look nice?
Out on bail?
What?
Oh, didn't you hear? Little sister got nabbed for possession last night.
Adam, how do you know about that?
I don't remember.
Was that you sneaking up the back stairs at 3 a.m. just when the phone rang? I'm just asking.
Out of date.
You were to be inside the house by midnight on Saturdays, young man.
Oh, yeah, I was.
We were parked in the garage talking.
Yeah, you and a girl were just talking.
Yeah, you remember girls.
Okay, slow down, boys.
Adam, mixed marriages never work.
Shouldn't you be sucking on a bong in the attic?
Excuse me.
Judith.
I'm having a martini. It's the weekend, it's afternoon, and I'm having a martini. But please continue. I believe you were calling your sister a drug addict.
Adopted sister, but I don't love her any less.
Jack Kenny, welcome to Fresh Air. Why did you want to have a priest, an Episcopal priest, at the center of a family drama?
Well, you know, I'd never seen it explored on television. I thought the idea, frankly, had been kicking around in my head for a couple of years, that I wanted to explore the life of a priest and his family in the same way that 6 Feet Under explored the life of people who own a funeral home, or the way that Sopranos explores the life of a mafia chieftain. In 6 Feet Under, the mortuary is a backdrop to the show. It's not about funeral directors. Just as Book of Daniel is not about the church or about religion, it is the backdrop for the show. It informs what he does and how he behaves. He is a true Christian in that he believes in all the tenets of Christianity. He is believes in God and Jesus as his savior, and you know all that comes with that. But it's never been about that. It's always been about a guy who's trying to be a better person, a better man, a better husband, a better father.
So when you created the Book of Daniel, did you think it would end up being as controversial as it's been? Did you think that there would be a campaign to get NBC to drop the show and a campaign to get sponsors to withdraw from the show or to not sign on in the first place?
No, I didn't. I have to excuse me for my laughing because the goal of the original pilot script was to get a meeting. I wanted to get a job. I was a newly single writer. I was trying to break into a genre that I had no experience in, and I wanted to get people's attention. So I put all of this stuff in, thinking, "Well, this will be a page turner," and it was. It got a lot of attention. I never even thought it would be produced, much less gone to series, and then all this. So the controversy is surprising to me on that level. But it's also surprising to me because the approach that I always took to this family was that their Christianity was second nature to them. It was not something they actively had to show people. It was not demonstrative. It was not proselytizing or missionary. They were just Christians. And in the same way that I've always wanted to see a gay character that was just gay, that everything in his life wasn't defined by the fact that he was gay, just as everything in Daniel's life isn't defined by the fact that he's a Christian. And so the idea that people think it's mocking Christianity shocks me in that it was written and meant with a sense of respect and honor for Christianity and its beliefs. And I thought that Daniel talking to Jesus about his problems and making Jesus an accessible, almost of a best friend type of character to Daniel, I thought would pull people into it rather than push people away. I was very surprised by it all.
Well, you mentioned that Daniel has conversations with Jesus, and that's turned out to be, I think, the single most controversial part of the series. The people who object to the series always seem to single that out. So I thought I'd play a scene from it and talk with you. A scene like that and talk with you about writing it. And this is a scene in which, let's just say as background, that Daniel had given his brother-in-law, Charlie, a job. And it was Charlie's job, among other things, to oversee the $3 million that was put aside to build a new school for the church. And Charlie has run away. He's found dead. The money's disappeared. And, you know, Daniel's kind of left not knowing what to do. So he tells the bishop that this has happened. She scolded him for trusting his brother-in-law. He leaves the church. Daniel leaves the church, and he's about to take a Vicodin, the painkiller that he takes, saying that his back hurts. And there's Jesus waiting for him. Jesus takes the bottle of pills out of Daniel's hands, gives him lifesavers instead, and they have this conversation.
You know, I really cared about Charlie. I went out on a limb for him. I would never, ever damn anybody. I couldn't. I'm sorry.
I know.
I was angry.
Don't worry. You don't have that much power.
Why is it so easy to talk to you?
Well, I'm a good listener. Plus, I never burden you with my problems.
You have problems?
Now we're talking about you.
Tell me what to do. I don't know what to do anymore.
Yes, you do.
No, I don't.
It's just hard. Life is hard, Daniel. For everyone. That's why there's such a nice reward at the end of it.
I know that's supposed to be comforting, but it's not. Aren't you supposed to comfort me?
Oh, where did you read that? Some Episcopalian self-help book? That's good. You should laugh more. Hey, have you read Jesus' Guide to a Comfortable Life? Very comforting, that one.
No, but I have read Men Are From Mars. Jesus is from heaven.
My Tuesdays with Jesus.
That's a scene from the Book of Daniel, and my guest is the creator and executive producer of the show, Jack Kenny. So Jack Kenny, tell us, why do you have the Episcopal priest in your show, Daniel, having conversations with Jesus? Do you see this as something that's happening in his mind? Is Jesus literally sitting next to him and having this conversation?
No, it's absolutely occurring in his mind. It's this is not about the return of Jesus to earth, and Daniel has not been chosen. There's even an earlier scene where Daniel asks Jesus, "Have I been chosen?" And Jesus says, "No." And Daniel says, "Well, why do you talk to me then?" And Jesus says, "I talk to everyone." And Daniel says, "Well, few mention it." And Jesus says, "Few hear me." And I think that's sort of the issue that I was hoping to bring about by bringing Jesus into this, was that for Christians, Jesus and God are always talking to us. And if we listen, we might be surprised to hear what they have to say to us. And in Daniel's case, he needed a best friend. He had his family, and he had the people he worked with, and I wanted him to have a best friend. And I was raised Catholic. I'm no longer practicing Catholicism, but I do practice homosexuality. If you read the AFA website, you'll find that out. Although I actually think I've gotten quite good at it. I wouldn't say I was practicing anymore, but I was always raised to believe that you were supposed to have a personal relationship with Jesus Christ, and I never really understood what that meant. And I thought, if I did have one, this is the way I would like it to be. I would like it to be my best friend, my partner, my everything. Somebody who knows everything about me and who's always there to remind me how to live my life. And what Jesus is there is to remind Daniel how to live his life, what he is here to do.
My guest is Jack Kenny, the creator and executive producer of the NBC series The Book of Daniel. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jack Kenny, the creator and executive producer of The Book of Daniel, the controversial new NBC series about an Episcopal priest and his family. Let me read you a couple of things that I'm sure you're already familiar with, but our audience is probably not, that were said about the program. The first is by the director of Focus on the Family's Plugged In department, and this is the department which examines popular culture.
Yes, he was yelling at me last night on the radio.
Okay, so the statement is, most egregious is the program's portrayal of Jesus. On Daniel, the individual believed to be the savior of the world by nearly a billion people around the globe is cast as a wimpy, white-robed visitor who cares little about evil, addictions, and perversity. This show is anti-Christian in the most fundamental way. It mocks God and the Word of God, period. And here's another quote from Brent Bozell, who's the founder and president of the conservative media watchdog group, the Parents Television Council. And he says, the most serious mockery in the show is the Jesus character. It's not that he's unlikable. It's just that he's clearly not God. Did you expect these kinds of criticisms of your portrayal of Jesus?
No, I don't understand why. There's so many things that I don't understand in terms of the response to this show. And I would agree, he is clearly not God. He was never intended to be God in this portrayal. He is Daniel's vision, Daniel's version of Jesus that Daniel is speaking to in his mind. He, as a matter of fact, there is no time in the pilot where anyone says his name. In reference to him, you know, Daniel never says, "Hey, Jesus." He never says his own name out loud. It's the assumption. That's why we dressed him in the most traditional garb we could find, so that you would instantly recognize who this character was. The thing that I don't understand is the accusation of mockery. I don't see how any part of the show can be conceived as mocking. All of these characters have flaws and faults with which they are struggling, but they have to have flaws and problems in order to overcome them.
You know, I was wondering, since your program is at the center of controversy now, do you remember when you were growing up and watching TV, if there was any programs you watched that were considered to be very controversial?
Oh, yeah, All in the Family. I remember watching All in the Family. I remember my dad getting very angry that there were people trying to take All in the Family off the air because he thought it was a great show and really funny, and he couldn't understand why people were not letting it stay on TV. It was the same argument. He was just saying, why don't they just change the channel? There's four channels, you know, and that was the days when there was only four, and you actually had to get up to change the channel, so it took a lot more effort. But there was All in the Family. There was that all the shows that spawned. I mean, I don't know. I don't know if you remember or if you. I don't know how old you are, but I remember the episode of Maude where Maude had an abortion. You know, because she was a woman in her 50s who had gotten pregnant and knew that she couldn't have this baby, that she wouldn't be able to handle it. And it was an extremely contentious episode at the time, an episode, by the way, that would never be able to be done today. As a matter of fact, I would say 80% of the episodes that All in the Family and Maude did at the time would never make it past the pitching stage today in today's environment.
So is controversy good for ratings as far as you're concerned?
You know, I think a certain amount is. I think to a certain degree the beginning of this controversy was. Now, frankly, I think people are getting sick of it. I think they're getting tired of hearing about on both sides. I mean, I think that probably the AFA supporters are starting to think, oh, would you shut up about it already? I get it. You don't want me to watch it. Okay. You know, and a lot of people have watched it who are on the side of the controversy and watched it and said, well, I don't understand what the big fuss is about. This seems fine. You know, this doesn't seem to be I don't necessarily agree with all of it, but then, you know, point me to a television show where you do.
Well, Jack Kenny, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. I've really enjoyed it. I love listening to your show, and I really, really appreciate your doing this and talking to me about our show.
Jack Kenny is the creator and executive producer of The Book of Daniel, which airs Friday nights on NBC. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, and Sam Brigger. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Franz Kafka's Metamorphosis, available in stores and online at bn.com. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. And from GM, committed to energy independence with vehicles that run on 85% ethanol and 15% gasoline. Details at onlygm.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The film Hustle and Flow, about a small-time pimp in Memphis whose dream is to become a rapper, is now out on DVD. On the next Fresh Air, we feature interviews with the film's writer and director, Craig Brewer, and its star, Terrence Howard. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.